Hello. The content of this programme is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. My name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. So today I'm going to read a longer article, which is about an exciting potential development coming out of UNC Pembroke. The next treatment for Alzheimer's disease could come out of UNC Pembroke, and the article is by Morgan Casey. Ben Barr, an internationally recognized researcher of neurodegenerative disorders, had two job offers in 2009, one from the University of Hawaii and another from the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. When he picked the latter, a lot of people asked why. "I get more work done at this type of school," Barr told them. UNC Pembroke is not an R1 university, a designation from the Carnegie Classification of Institutions of Higher Education for schools that focus heavily on research. Barr said he previously worked at the University of Connecticut, an R1 school, where he had many hats to wear. With fewer administrative responsibilities, Barr knew he could focus more on his passion developing new drugs to treat neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's. UNC Pembroke gave him an empty lab at its Biotechnology Research and Training Center. Today, Barr's Alzheimer's disease research lab is developing what he hopes will be low-cost pharmaceuticals for patients with Alzheimer's disease. He says a promising ingredient in that treatment is American ginseng. Barr and his team took slices of rats' brains and aged them in a refrigerator for 18 to 20 days before treating them with the herb. They suspected that the ginseng would trigger a specific enzyme that helps clear a brain pathway of the built-up proteins believed to cause Alzheimer's and similar neurodegenerative disorders. They were right. According to a peer-reviewed research paper that Barr co-authored, the findings were published in the December issue of Alzheimer's and Dementia, the Journal of the Alzheimer's Association. Other researchers have also said that the herb can improve cognition for people with impaired memories. Scientists who conducted a study in Korea between 2010 and 2016 found that people older than 60 who consumed any type of ginseng for at least 5 years had a lower incidence rate of dementia, according to a 2018 research article in the peer-reviewed journal Alzheimer's Research and Therapy. The findings support Barr's theory that combining a natural product found in a healthy diet, like ginseng, and a specific molecule that targets Alzheimer's could slow the disease's progression. He hopes his patented treatment method will produce a pill to combat the disease. Ultimately, he wants a drug company to invest in the product and get approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. NC Innovation, a state-funded nonprofit that helps public universities commercialize promising research, gave Barr's lab a two-year, $1.1 million grant last May. He plans to use the money to send a handful of molecules to a company that will test them on mice that are genetically altered to have the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. The company will determine which molecule works best at slowing the disease, Barr said. "We're at the very early stages," he said, "but we're excited." NC Innovation, a state-funded nonprofit that helps public universities commercialize promising research. I apologize, I'm rereading that. Barr said he hopes to get the second year of funding this summer, despite questions about the future of NC Innovation. North Carolina still doesn't have a budget, but both the House and Senate proposals would claw back $500 million and redirect it to hurricane recovery efforts. Thinking outside the box. Barr grew up in California and knew he wanted to go into research. He enrolled at the University of California, Santa Barbara as an undergraduate and landed a spot in a lab researching Alzheimer's and other brain diseases. Barr found drug development the most fascinating. He stayed at Santa Barbara to earn his doctoral degree in chemistry and then joined UC Irvine's Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory as an associate researcher and lecturer. He became an associate professor of pharmaceutical sciences at the University of Connecticut in the late 1990s, staying at the school for over a decade before joining UNC Pembroke. Scientists have gained a better understanding of Alzheimer's disease over the decades, but Barr said the development of treatments has been slow because Alzheimer's is the most complicated disease known. Last year, the drug company Johnson & Johnson ended a study of an injectable treatment after it failed to slow the disease progress in a statistically significant way. Novo Nordisk wanted to know if GLP-1 weight loss drugs could, but clinical trials showed they did not have an impact. An estimated 7.2 million Americans 65 and older are living with Alzheimer's, including 210,500 North Carolinians, according to the Alzheimer's Association. The number of US adults developing various forms of dementia is expected to increase by 1 million each year by 2060, according to a study published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Medicine. Barr said it's possible that his treatment could also work for Parkinson's disease, which involves a buildup of proteins in the same brain pathway. About 500,000 Americans are living with Parkinson's, according to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, a number expected to double by 2040. Currently, the only drugs that slow the progression of Alzheimer's are delivered intravenously, meaning patients have to go to clinics for treatment. He said the treatment he is developing can be taken orally. "We're trying to think outside the box," Barr said. "What about a combination therapy, combining natural products with a small molecule?" The biggest hurdle is still money. That's why Barr hopes a drug company will get on board to help cover the costs of testing, paperwork, and federal requirements. "For a small campus like UNCP, it's incredibly difficult," Barr said. Unlike most research universities, UNC Pembroke doesn't have a technology transfer office to help Barr commercialize his findings. Barr said he tries hard to convince the school's administrators that it is their social responsibility to people with neurological disorders. "Half my job is just working on my university to take this seriously," Barr said. Helping the next generation. Despite the challenges, UNC Pembroke has increased its focus on healthcare. Last year, the university welcomed its first class in a Master of Healthcare Administration program. The first students in its Doctor of Nursing Practice program graduated in December, and the school plans to open the state's only optometry program at a public university in 2027. When senior biology major Natalie Pacheco transferred from UNC Wilmington last year, she was surprised to learn about Pembroke's Alzheimer's research lab, and she signed up to be a research assistant. Pacheco, 25, is from Johnston County. She said Barr renewed her passion for science after she lost interest in academics during the pandemic. "He's like somebody's dad," she said. "He's really pushing you along because he wants you to succeed. He wants you to find what you like to do. He wants you to do good." "Barr makes the work fun," Pacheco said. "Sometimes he breaks down complicated laboratory procedures into steps as if he were making brownies." Barr's lab lost its financial support for undergraduate research assistants briefly last year when the National Institutes of Health cancelled the Undergraduate Research Training Initiative for Student Enhancement Grant. The program aims to increase the diversity of undergraduates who go on to pursue graduate and doctoral degrees in research-focused biomedicine programs. Almost as suddenly as the grant was revoked, it was reinstated last month, Barr said. An NIH spokesperson told the Border Belt Independent that it cannot comment on the status of individual grant applications or deliberations, but that the agency remains committed to supporting rigorous, evidence-based research that advances the health of all Americans. Women and people of color have long been underrepresented in STEM fields, according to the U.S. National Science Foundation. As a Latina researcher and daughter of immigrants, Pacheco said she's thankful to have the opportunity at UNC Pembroke. "We're not from this prestigious place," Pacheco said. "This is a community that's underrepresented, but there are great people here who can do great things." For Barr, the funding means he can support more research assistants and keep pushing towards treatments for neurodegenerative disorders. "Everything we learn about the brain doing Alzheimer's research helps other diseases and even our quality of life," Barr said. "So there's lots to be learning." Well, a change of pace now, we're going to talk about books. The epic real-life friendship behind an acclaimed novel, and this is by John Drescher. Three college guys used to hang out at a house a few blocks from the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Two of them lived there, the third was a close friend who lived at his fraternity, but spent most of his time at the rented house on North Street. The three, all English majors from other states, were smart, well-read. Individually, none would have been considered charismatic, but together they were witty, free-flowing, and magnetic. Other students dropped by the house to enjoy the banter and intellectual stimulation. They were juniors and seniors, 20 or 21 years old, and they talked about the kinds of silly things that college students talk about when they have time on their hands. But the three guys, JB, Jeff, and Kevin, were also interested in big ideas. They parried verbally as they talked about their professors, what they'd read recently, and what was in the news. The writer, Lily King, another English major from out of state, was drawn to them when they were all Carolina students in the mid-80s. "Our university was big, but these three guys had created a tiny, cozy world within it," King wrote in a 2020 article in Vogue. "The rest of the fall and winter, we played hearts and argued about Reagan's re-election. We talked in Irish accents and quoted James Joyce. With the three of them, I was always giddy from the banter." King wrote about the love triangle between her, JB, and Jeff. "She first dated JB, who she met in their 17th century literature class, but fell in love with Jeff." King wrote about the three men again last year in her well-regarded novel, Heart the Lover. The New York Times and the Washington Post reviewed it warmly. Time magazine ranked it first in its list of the 10 best books of the year. What begins as the hormone-fueled story of a campus love triangle, punctuated by bad sex and the heady banter of English majors, reveals itself to hold far greater weight, wrote Times Lucy Feldman. Neither the real-life story nor the novel has a happy ending. Kevin Wolfe died of lymphoma in 2001 at 38. Jeff Darcy died of lung cancer in 2019 at 56. J.B. Howard tended to both of them in their last days. Disclosure: Howard has been a good friend since college, and I knew Wolfe and Darcy through him. I never met King at UNC Chapel Hill. The novel has created a buzz among their old college friends, now in their 60s, about what's fiction and what's not. But what's unquestionably real is the unusual male friendship that King portrays in Heart the Lover. It's three guys who loved each other, said their friend Jeb Saunders, a state government lawyer who lives in Chapel Hill. But for Kevin and Jeff dying, they would have remained lifelong friends. What a gift that was to have that friendship at such a young age. They left an imprint on King even decades after she first hung out with them. "I don't know that I see that quality of male friendship very often," she told me. "I don't know how much in everyday life men really lean on each other and care for each other." The triumvirate. The first time Howard met Wolf, when they were high school seniors, he detested him. They were invited to Chapel Hill for a weekend in late February as finalists for the prestigious Moorhead Scholarship. Howard, from Baltimore, thought Wolf, from New Jersey, was an insufferably arrogant Northeasterner. Wolf walked around the leafy old campus all weekend with his nose up in the air, Howard told me. 6 months later, they were both Moorhead scholars living in Old East Dorm, just a few steps from the old well, the best-known landmark at the university. This time, they hit it off. Howard later wrote to friends that Wolf turned out to be the most good-hearted, caring, and interesting friend anyone could ever have. Darcy, a horse racing fan from Kentucky and a passionate reader, also lived in the dorm. The three discovered they had a lot in common. They stayed up most of an October night talking, which was the beginning of a conversation that lasted for years. Their friends appreciated their intellects and passion for exploring ideas. "They were really impressive," said Tim Sullivan, who became the CEO of Ancestry.com and now lives in Chapel Hill. Sullivan is a member of the Assembly's board. "They were the reminder to me of why we were here at the university. They so clearly admired each other as friends and respected each other." Wolf, the most extroverted of the three, could be zany. He called himself the Wolfman and poked fun at himself by mock bragging about his dating skills. His friends say, chuckling, that the character in the novel based on Wolf, his name is Ivan, fits him perfectly. In the novel, Ivan / Kevin returns to their unnamed college town after visiting Ireland in the summer. Then he tells us about the landlord's daughter, the ferryman's sister, and a pretty French girl on the flight home, who told him in a sexy accent that if they didn't hold hands during takeoff, the plane would crash, writes the female narrator. But once they were safely in the air, she let go and refused to speak to him for the rest of the flight. He is amused that everything he says delights us. Wolf taught himself Mandarin Chinese and was fluent. He later moved to Hong Kong and pursued beautiful Asian women, which Howard said was as ardent and quixotic as it was hilarious. "I adored Kevin," said Carolyn Griffin Hall, who frequented the North Street House in college and is now a community volunteer in Nashville, Tennessee. "He was so funny. He was like a little quirky gnome. He was delightful and super smart." While Wolf was exuberant, Darcy had an endearing sense of humour about his foibles and predicaments. His 6-page handwritten letter on a yellow legal pad, as usual, to a former professor in 1995 was classic Darcy. He described reading Dylan Thomas's nostalgic poem, Fern Hill, to his dying father as he lived his last days wheelchair-bound at his Kentucky farmhouse. Also present were Darcy's brother and stepmother. Jeff Darcy began bravely, but was overcome with emotion as he sought to meet the moment with the perfect farewell. He struggled to finish, but did. "Oh, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea." He thought his family was deeply touched, until he realized they were actually trying not to laugh. "Everyone was grateful and relieved when I started laughing also," Darcy wrote. Howard was the quietest of the three. He was an English and classics major, studying the major Greek and Latin authors. He also played backup goalie on a UNC Chapel Hill men's lacrosse team that won a national championship. Howard stood out on a team of ruffians. Saunders, a lacrosse teammate, grew his hair long in an effort to fit in. Howard didn't change his fumbling, over-caffeinated coffee-drinking persona, nor his daily uniform of button-down Oxford cloth shirts and khakis. Though quirky, he had a measured, mature beyond his years sense of who he was. His teammates respected him for it, and though many thought he was the most interesting guy on the team. Louise Gilbert Freeman, an artist and former college English professor who lives in Virginia, was friends with Darcy at prep school and with all three in Chapel Hill. She and her college friends called them the Triumvirate. They were intellectual compatriots, but they were also bonded in the way typical of male college friends. Lots of jocular ribbing, a shared private lexicon, she wrote in an unpublished essay after Darcy died. I was flattered to be included somewhere in that charmed circle, even as a ripple on the outer rim. I cared so much what they thought of me. Lean on me. They stayed close after college. All three went to law school, Wolfe and Darcy at the University of Michigan and Howard at the University of Virginia. Wolfe worked for an international law firm in Hong Kong, returned to the US and never married. Darcy was involved with King on and off for a decade, but they ultimately split and established a long friendship. He stayed single. Howard married, had three sons, one named after Darcy, and divorced. The three men worked their schedules to see each other at least half a dozen times a year. They got together in New York City, at the beach, at weddings, on a cycling trip to Michigan's Upper Peninsula. There was always something to look forward to, Howard told me recently. We all found each other interesting in some way. It's a unique friendship when you can create this world that you're happy in with two other friends. He added, I liked being around two guys who were really, really smart, and smarter than I was. We pushed each other in that way. It was truly a three-way friendship, he said. There was never a time when one was excluded by the others. Only death did that. Wolfe got cancer in the late 1990s. Howard and Darcy stayed close to him in his last years, researching his illness and arranging visits with his old friends, urging him on. On a train ride to New York to see Wolfe, Darcy said to Howard, "Do you realize how hard this is going to be when he dies?" "Kevin fought really, really hard," Howard said. Wolfe endured a long period of chemo and radiation, hope and despair. He died in New Jersey in 2001 with Darcy and Howard at his side. Darcy and Howard's friendship, already strong, was cemented in their late 30s by Wolfe's death. For more than a decade, the two worked for the Maryland Attorney General. They saw each other regularly, with Darcy becoming Uncle Jeff to Howard's three sons. Years before, when they were young, Darcy's romance with King had strained their friendship. King and Howard broke up at the end of Howard's senior year in 1985, long before the internet and cell phones. When Howard returned to the US from a summer trip to Europe, he learned his close friend and his former girlfriend were still students, were dating. He was angry, not because he had hoped to rekindle his relationship with King, he told me, but because he thought Darcy had broken an Ernest Hemingway-esque code of masculine friendship. A man didn't date his close friend's former girlfriend, especially right after their breakup. King knew all of this. She and Darcy kept their relationship entirely separate from his friendship with Howard. If Howard was in town and the guys went to a party, she could not go. If Darcy called Howard, King was not in the room. In Vogue and in the novel, she describes their predicament in similar language. Darcy would lose his friendship with Howard if he chose King. King would lose Darcy if he chose Howard. It might have appeared that way at the time, but in the end, Howard and Darcy and Wolfe remained close. Darcy's romance with King created a real strain on my friendship with Jeff, Howard wrote in a recent email to friends, but there was no force in the universe that was going to break our friendship with each other and with Kevin. One night only. Darcy, a long-time smoker, was diagnosed with cancer in late 2016. Howard accompanied him on doctor's visits. When Darcy was hospitalized for the final time in March 2019 in Baltimore, Howard slept for several weeks on a fold-out cot in the room and he spoke throughout the day with Darcy's doctors and nurses about his treatment. Howard also urged King, who lives in Maine, to visit, and quickly. When she arrived, she joined a raucous party in the hospital room, an NCAA tournament basketball game blaring from the TV amidst cheering and shouting. Darcy was in bed, hooked up to oxygen, his chest exposed, but joyous to be surrounded by the people he loved most. Darcy was witty as usual. "You should do stand-up comedy," someone said. "Yeah," he responded, according to one of his friends. "Jeff Darcy, one night only." Everyone in that room during Darcy's last week felt a kind of mystic power. Freeman, his friend from prep school, said Darcy allowed his friends to see him raw and exposed, stripping them of everything superficial and extraneous. The parade of people finally dissipated one night. King writes movingly in the Vogue article about being alone with Howard and Darcy in his last hours, joined by Wolfe's spirit. His evil grin and cackle laugh. "He came back then and sat in the room with us," she wrote. "I could hear him shuffling the cards." King's hospital visit marked the first time she'd seen Howard in decades. "He was kind and warm and grateful for her presence, even though I'd almost ruined their friendship decades ago," she wrote. She'd never considered her romance with Darcy from Howard's point of view. What if her best friend had started dating Darcy as soon as she left town? Would she have forgiven her? Would King have slept in her hospital room night after night? King told me that being with Darcy and the others at the end was heartbreaking and excruciatingly beautiful all at the same time. She felt honoured and privileged to be included. "As a novelist," King said, "you have to let the characters do what they're going to do." But she said she wanted to capture Darcy's essence, as well as his friendship with Howard, a kind of male friendship she'd never seen before. "That friendship is the big story in her book," she's often told, and she agrees. Howard thought he was holding it all together at the hospital, but when he saw the Wolfe family, the floodgates opened. Their presence was a reminder of the pain and joy of a friendship that started long ago on an October night in an old dorm. Three freshmen excited about finding their way forward in a new world full of promise. Kevin and Jeff are together now, he wrote. I can't wait to see them again. John Drescher is a senior editor of the Assembly. He previously served as deputy editor of the Washington Post's political investigations team, the executive editor of the News and Observer, and managing director of The State. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, and if you have any questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you so much for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.